You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, primordial gravitational waves turn to dust, and why that's good news for inflation theory.
We want bicep to be right, we want Planck to be right, and we want inflation to be right. But we found there wasn't actually any way to make all three of these things right simultaneously. Just a horrendous irony, I think.
One past, two futures. Julian Barber explains how gravity gives rise to the arrow of time.
This is the miracle of gravity. Gravity creates this. It's the ancient Greek dream of order being created out of chaos.
And Paul Davis talks about the physics of cancer.
Cancer is a biological phenomenon. It's not well understood. Will we understand it by just throwing money at it? No, we can't spend our way to a solution. We've got to think our way to a solution.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali. Welcome to the latest podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. Once again, we find ourselves talking about the announcement from March this year that astronomers had detected the first evidence of primordial gravitational waves. This has been in and out of the news, for good and bad, over the past 6 months. You'll remember that this discovery was touted as the first direct proof of cosmic inflation theory, the idea that the early universe went through a period of rapid expansion. On the May and June podcasts, we heard from inflation's founding fathers Alan Guth and Andre Linde about how the discovery supports inflation.
But does it really prove inflation theory? I put it to you, Brendan, that actually the opposite is true, and the detection of primordial gravitational waves by BICEP2 actually disproves inflation.
What? No, that's crazy!
It's what a new analysis surprisingly suggests, but I'll come back to that in a minute after we've spoken a bit about dust.
Ah yes, dust. Keen podcast listeners will remember the long-running concern over whether the BICEP2 team even detected gravitational waves or whether they'd actually been fooled by space dust. The trouble was that the BICEP2 team examined light in the cosmic microwave background, that is, the radiation left over after the Big Bang. They announced evidence of B modes, a twisted polarization pattern in the light, which they attributed to primordial gravitational waves. But again, in the May and June podcasts, we discussed concerns that possibly this polarization pattern was produced by dust and not gravitational waves at all. If I recall correctly, we were waiting for independent data from the European Space Agency's Planck satellite to try and clear up this mess.
Indeed, we were. And some of that data has now come in. In September, the Planck collaboration released intermediate data which showed that there's likely to be more dust in the region examined by BICEP2 than the BICEP2 team originally accounted for. In fact, it's possible that the entire signal is just dust. It's also possible, however, that it's not, and there are in fact gravitational waves.
Well, that clears everything up.
I don't blame you for being confused or annoyed, Brendan. Earlier, I spoke with Andrew Liddell, an astrophysicist at the Royal Observatory Edinburgh, to try and work out what to make of all of this. Liddell is a member of the Planck collaboration, although he wasn't involved in this particular paper. He talked me through the latest findings from Planck and what they mean in terms of what may or may not have been detected by BICEP2. Even more intriguingly, in a separate analysis, Liddell and his colleagues have calculated that if the BICEP2 signal is not due to dust and does in fact represent the detection of primordial gravitational waves, then in fact that result is not compatible with inflation. At least, not with the simplest models of inflation. Liddell told me all about this surprising result after reviewing the implications of the Planck analysis of dust for the BICEP2 result. Spoiler alert, It's not good news. Little began by explaining why it's so hard for astronomers to unpick whether the B-mode signal is caused by gravitational waves or by dust.
So I think one of the important things to remember, first of all, is that any of these signals is very faint indeed. So we're always struggling just at the limits of what can be detected. So when BICEP2 produced their results, they were looking for an interpretation in terms of primordial gravitational waves. And it looked as a headline result very strong. They were quoting 7 sigma, which is really a very statistically secure sounding signal. But nevertheless, they were digging very deep into their data in order to produce that. So if you have a map of these famous B modes, it's not as if you can look at the map and they immediately jump out to you as being something very visible. It's really hidden in the details of the analysis and the statistical measurements. So because of that, there are different possible sources that can contribute to the signal that BICEP2 is seeing. And they thought that they had a good handle on possible contribution from dust grains, which are probably within our own galaxy and therefore much, much closer to us than the origin of the microwave background. They thought they had a good handle on the possible signal, but quickly people began to doubt whether that was really the case.
And so, you know, people were waiting for this Planck paper to come out and say something about dust. And now a paper has come out. Can you explain what exactly was found?
So what Planck's been doing is it's been making measurements, it's been making maps of the sky. And in a channel known as the 353 gigahertz channel, it's just jargon really, but it's the frequency of the observations, that channel is primarily sensitive to emission from the dust. And so it's been making maps and trying to guess what the distribution of dust is within our galaxy, and particularly what the polarization of that dust is, which is the thing which is key to the gravitational waves and to BICEP. The trouble is that BICEP2 measures at quite a different frequency. They measure light, which is longer wavelength, 150 gigahertz. And there's quite a bit of uncertainty in extrapolating from the Planck measurements down to what might be seen at another frequency. It's a bit like if you have an image made in blue light, you're trying to guess what things might look like if you were instead using a red filter. It wouldn't necessarily be that easy to predict one from the other, so a few assumptions have to go in there. So the thing people have been waiting for from Planck is to get measurements which are relevant specifically to the BICEP2 region of the sky.
And so what is the sort of the take-home message of the paper? Is it saying that BICEP2 most likely saw dust? Can it say whether or not gravitational waves were there or not there?
The message that we seem to be getting from the Planck paper is that there is a dust signal and there should be a dust signal which is in the BICEP2 region. And the inference from Planck is that probably the amount of dust in the BICEP2 region is quite significantly higher than had been assumed when BICEP2 wrote their paper. On the other hand, the Planck measurement is quite uncertain, and without combining Planck and BICEP data, there remains quite a bit of uncertainty in that. So the Planck signal is consistent with quite a wide range of contributions from dust, certainly at the high end. Planck's measurement would suggest that all of the BICEP2 signal could be dust, but it does leave some room for the possibility that that's not, and that BICEP2 has some part of a cosmological signal in it.
Now, you mentioned that it's important for some kind of joint analysis between the two groups, between BICEP2 and Planck. Is that something that's in the works?
Yes.
And what will that be looking at?
Yes, that's underway. So there is a memorandum of understanding between the two teams to share their data. Planck is at the moment working towards its next release of its own data for cosmology, which is due towards the end of this calendar year. But at the same time, are also trying to work with the BICEP2 team, and hopefully something may come out on a fairly similar timescale, so within the next few months.
Now, you've actually been involved in another piece of work that's independent from the actual Planck result. And you've sort of been analysing different scenarios in terms of the amount of dust that might be there and kind of comparing the results and looking at what that might tell us about the kind of models of inflation that could fit with that sort of data or the interpretations. Could you talk a little bit more about the aim of that paper?
Yes, it's a paper that we've just submitted to the archive. It's by Marina Cortes and myself at Edinburgh and David Parkinson at University of Queensland in Australia. And we've been working on it for quite a while since BICEP 2 first came out earlier in the year. Originally, from quite a theoretical perspective, we wanted to go really back to the basics and try and really define the models we wanted to compare to the data, particularly inflation models, and try and understand what kinds of inflation models might be compatible with the data that we had, which was the earlier release of the Planck data, older data from the WMAP satellite, and then the new BICEP 2 data. Two things had happened very quickly after BICEP 2 came out. One was that quite a few papers had noted that the BICEP 2 signal was really higher than would be expected based on what the Planck satellite had already shown for how much gravitational waves could be there. The BICEP signal was perhaps twice as high as an upper limit that the Planck satellite had set. The numbers are not quite directly comparable. They're probing slightly different things, but nevertheless, it was noted that that discrepancy was there and that actually simple inflation models were not very good at explaining that change in signal. So there's some worries on the theoretical side already. And also very quickly after the BICEP result came out, there started to be these rumors of the possibility of dust contamination. And there were some papers, particularly by Mortensen and Selyak and by Flauger et al., which seemed to indicate that dust could be quite a problem for BICEP. So we want to carry out a new analysis of the data that made some different models for the dust, and the idea was to try and see how introducing the dust would modify the way we'd understand inflation models and whether it could make inflation models more compatible with the combination of Planck and BICEP data.
And so what did you find for the different scenarios? I guess you looked across a range of, you know, a lot of dust and then not very much dust.
So one of the things that I was particularly interested in was there was this discrepancy I just mentioned where the normal inflation models actually couldn't simultaneously explain the Planck upper limits and the BICEP signal. And dust is a possible explanation for why that might be true. If some of the BICEP signal is due to dust rather than due to primordial gravitational waves, that means you don't have to explain so much of a signal. It could bring BICEP back in line with the limits that Planck gave. And so that was one of the things we were interested in, was to see whether or not there were scenarios where BICEP could still have detected the gravitational waves, but in a region that was more compatible with standard inflation models. In fact, we didn't show that.
Oh.
What was discovered was instead that if there is a contribution from dust, if the dust is strong enough to allow the standard models of inflation to explain the data, then it removed too much of the signal, and although there might be a gravitational wave contribution to BICEP, BICEP just doesn't have the sensitivity to measure it in any kind of convincing way. So that's an interesting corner we've been painted into. We wanted BICEP to be right, we wanted Planck to be right, and we wanted inflation to be right, but we found there wasn't actually any way to make all three of these things right simultaneously. One of them has to be turned down. When I say inflation right, I really mean the simpler models of inflation, the ones where go back a long time to models by Linde and other people like that. There are always complicated inflation models that you can try to use to explain more complicated kinds of data.
So there's some irony here, I guess, that originally in March, the BICEP 2 results were being presented as this kind of proof of inflation. But now, if we want to hold on to the simple models of inflation, it might actually be better if the result is down to dust and there isn't a BICEP 2 signal. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, you're exactly right. It's a horrendous irony, I think. And one, to be fair, that had become apparent from some of the very early works just after the BICEP result came out that seemed to show that the BICEP signal was unreasonably large by the standards expected from inflation models. But yeah, you're spot on. It sounded like gravitational waves were a good thing for inflation, but in fact, if BICEP had been precisely right, it would have painted us into a very difficult corner where none of the simple inflation models would have worked.
That was Andrew Little talking with Zia. So, in summary, the BICEP 2 result could be completely due to dust, or maybe not. But if it's really due to gravitational waves, that would be bad news for simple models of inflation. Or there's something wrong with the previous Planck data. But more complicated inflation models could potentially make everything fit. My, my, my.
You can hear previous interviews in this long-running saga with André Linde, Alan Guth, João Magaggio, and Malcolm Fairbairn. Links can be found on the podcast page www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
I bet the Bicep 2 team wishes it could turn back time and play down its announcement from March. But sadly, the arrow of time only points in one direction.
Or maybe the arrow of time points in two directions.
You're determined to argue with everything I say today, aren't you? Where have you got this notion from?
From physicist Julian Barber of Oxford University, who has a new paper in Physical Review Letters explaining the origin of time's arrow. Just why time marches in one direction has troubled physicists because the underlying microscopic laws of physics are symmetric. But in new work, Barber and colleagues have carried out an analysis that suggests that at the Big Bang, two mirror universes were created, with arrows of time pointing in opposite directions, preserving symmetry. I recently met up with Barber and one of his co-authors, Flavio McCarty, while they were attending a meeting at Imperial College London. They told me about their new research, how it led them to identify a gravitational arrow of time, and how all this reminds them of Roman mythology.
So it was suddenly like the Roman god Janus, who looks in two ways at once. There is a central point, and in both directions, it looks the same. If you say time is moving in the direction in which structure is growing, then on either side of this Janus point, the middle of the two heads of Janus, you will say time is pointing in opposite directions and time is growing. That's the direction in which time is increasing. And really everything we've been doing has followed from this realization.
In Roman mythology, Janus is the god of beginnings and transitions and is famously depicted with two faces, joined at the back of the head and facing out in opposite directions. Presenting his latest research at a conference at Imperial College London in September, Oxford physicist Julian Barber, whom we just heard, used an image of the two-faced god to illustrate his new theory of the gravitational origin of the arrow of time. In his view, the Big Bang created two universes with two arrows of time pointing, like Janus's faces, in opposite directions. The arrow of time has long perplexed physicists because it forces us to march in only one direction, from the past to the future. Yet the equations that underlie physics at the microscopic level are time symmetric. That is, reactions and processes could just as easily have occurred forwards or backwards. So how is time's arrow imposed on the universe while this underlying symmetry is suppressed? I caught up with Barber and one of his co-authors, Flavio McCarty of the Perimeter Institute, during a busy and noisy lunch break in the meeting at London's Victorian Albert Museum. Barber told me more about their new paper, written with Perimeter's Tim Kozlovsky. The team theoretically analysed the motion of particles in the universe and how they clump together to create structure, and then reverse time to see how that behaviour was affected, leading them to their surprising discovery.
The paper that came out yesterday in Physical Review Letters is just about this idea of thinking about the arrow of time being defined by gravitational creation of structure. It goes back to a long-standing interest. I've been interested in the question of the arrow of time as long as I can remember. So it's always been at the back of my mind. And the paper most recently came out of, actually, Flavio and I decided we needed to make a grant application 2.5 years ago. And in making that grant application, just one idea occurred to me, which has really been key to all of the later developments, was, you see, the basic laws of Newton and Einstein are time reversal symmetric. They don't distinguish between the direction of time. And normally, particularly when you think about a gravitational system, they start with, shall we say, a fairly uniform distribution of particles in gravity, a fairly uniform state, And then they notice that the uniformity disappears, it tends to clump. This is called the genes instability, and it leads to what people call anti-thermodynamic behavior of gravity. It has negative specific heat. If you take energy out of an ordinary system, its temperature goes down. If you take energy out of a self-gravitating system, its energy goes up. The thing that finally occurred to me, I mean, I'd been very close to this idea for a long time, but it was in the talking to Flavio about things. But in the process, it led me to say, well, what happens if instead of just following the instability as it gets hotter and hotter, we reverse the arrow, the direction in which all the particles are going, and seeing what happens? Well, what we've realized is that then as you go in the opposite time direction, the system gets even more uniform, and then it passes through a very special point, and as it comes out the other side, it also goes into this situation where it's getting hotter, and it's symmetric on the other side.
So let me ask you, is this a mathematical result, or is it something that you're saying physically happens, that if you have a big bang, you know, we might find ourselves in one universe where we think time is going forward, but at the same time, another universe must be created to kind of balance out the symmetry. Is that just something that's a mathematical result, or does this actually happen?
The key thing is to take the law seriously and say the law is correct. And then it's just, at least in the Newtonian theory, it's an inescapable consequence of the law. It's a delight for us. Nobody seems to have thought of this before, and we stumbled on it by accident, you know. It's nothing like having to write a grant proposal.
Barber's picture of a double-faced Big Bang, creating two universes with two time arrows, reinstates the underlying time symmetry. The Big Bang, rather than being the initial point of the universe, is the midpoint, or Janus point, as Barber calls it, between twin universes which share one past but have two futures. This discovery led the team to make a startling claim about the relationship between time's arrow and entropy, a measure of the disorder of the universe. Physicists usually say that time marches in the direction in which entropy, or disorder, increases. This has often led them to puzzle over the mystery of why the universe began with low entropy in the first place. Barber, however, claims that the opposite is true, and that the Janus point, the point of the Big Bang, represents maximum entropy, and then in both the universes that are created, time tracks the direction in which entropy decreases.
People think, and have thought for a long time, that the universe must have started with an extremely low entropy. This is called the past hypothesis. Past hypothesis is from David Albert, the philosopher of science. And people have been very influenced by Roger Penrose's idea that the gravitational entropy must have been very low, although we know that the matter was in thermal equilibrium at the Big Bang. Now, if our ideas are right, and there's still an if, this is certainly right in Newtonian theory, and because Newtonian theory has many structural features in common with Einstein's gravity, we are hopeful that it will go through there. In fact, it turns out to be quite the opposite. Actually, the entropy is maximal at the Big Bang of the universe, and it's been going down ever since. But you have to distinguish between the entropy of the whole universe and the entropy of subsystems within it.
So I have to ask you a little bit more about this idea of kind of turning entropy on its head and the way that we usually talk about the progression of time. And you're sort of saying, well, we start off at the Big Bang with maximum entropy and we're moving towards low entropy. So can you give us a picture to understand what's happening, I guess, in terms of disorder and complexity in the universe to kind of track it? Or what is your definition of entropy?
The definition of entropy we use is a very precise one. It goes back 130, 140 years ago to Boltzmann, who characterized what you would expect to find when you open a box that's got gas particles in. And then he can show that with overwhelming probability, they will all be more or less very uniformly distributed in the box, and the velocities will be random. They'll be whizzing around, but there will be an average speed. This was the discovery of Maxwell, actually, and it's known as the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So what we're saying is that at the Big Bang, the universe looks like that. This certainly follows from our Newtonian model. And then if you follow the solution in either direction from the Janus point, when you get sufficiently far from the Janus point, you find that structures are forming. It gets more clustered. We can quantify this very precisely in terms of what we call the complexity. And the complexity is really the opposite of the entropy. So as the complexity grows, that means it's an improbable thing. It's like finding all the atoms in one corner of a box. But actually what you're finding, if you look around the universe, a priori, it's extremely improbable. I mean, just imagine the improbability of you and me sitting here over lunch, Sia. It's just unbelievable. And all I'm saying is, this is the miracle of gravity. Gravity creates this. It's the ancient Greek dream of order being created out of chaos.
That's lovely. When you have this time symmetric solution and you have these kind of two mirror universes, in your solution, are they the same solution? Is exactly the same thing happening on both sides, or can they be two different universes with different fates for the particles?
Oh, absolutely. The important thing, this was nice in the Janus image that I showed, that the two sides of the Janus head are not exactly the same. They look the same, more or less, but there are features. One has got graying hair, you know, and the other. I mean, and they could be as different as me as Flavio. I mean, put us back to back. Flavio looks that way, I look this way. I'm manifestly different from Flavio. I'm about the same height, so we, you know, we could. No, Flavio's a bit taller than me, but nevertheless, that's the image, and this follows automatically out of the mathematics. It's absolutely there. There is an absolutely exceptional case which you can forget about, where it's exactly the same on two sides. That's a very special case.
Barber's analysis is based on his long-running project to reformulate physics without reference to sizes and distances between objects. He and his collaborators have developed a framework that they call shape dynamics, in which the most fundamental description of particles in the universe refers to the way that shapes mapped out by particles in relation to each other change, but without reference to the absolute distances between them.
Well, very important in this is that we say that actually all you ever see is shape. You don't see overall size. When you look at the sky, you see the shape that the constellations make on the sky. You don't see how far away the stars are. So in some senses, size is invisible if you're within the system. This is a crucial part. This is why we call our theory shape dynamics.
You've got a mathematical formulation, and in that formulation, I guess when physicists usually kind of try and do calculations, they take into account the size, they talk about the universe expanding, getting bigger. But you've got a formulation where that's kind of irrelevant. Is this just a mathematical trick in terms of taking out any references to distances and scales in the mathematics, or are you saying that fundamentally there is no size in the universe?
I'm much more on the fundamental size. Now, it's very interesting when you look at both Newton and Einstein, at least at the level of the classical theory. I won't talk about quantum gravity, which does not yet exist, so we don't have to worry about that too much at this stage. When you look at the universe in its totality as a classical system, there is absolutely no meaning to its overall size. But what is very important is there is meaning to the change of its size. It is meaningful to say the universe now is twice as big as it was at some earlier epoch.
Well, Flavio, let me ask you a little bit about the analysis that you carried out. So, as I understand it from Julian's talk earlier, when you were trying to sort of look at what happens in the universe, you looked at a case of three particles in the universe. Is that correct? To kind of simplify the model. And then you're using this formulation where there's no scale involved. And can you talk about how that led to this discovery that you're now talking about, you know, this one past, two futures? How does that come out of the mathematics?
So what we did was actually to also do simulations with more than three particles, up to 1,000. There was this master's student who helped us, actually, Jerome Barclay, with whom we had some interactions at a distance. He was running simulations for us. So the three-body case is particularly useful because you can write down the equations explicitly. In this way, we could check our hypothesis on the three-body problem and explicitly prove them, and then check the like 1,000-body case with simulations, and we would actually see particles going through this distinguished point, which Julian now called Janus surface, whatever. And then formulate an actual theorem based on mainly the work by Marshall and Sari. Let's say both simulations, analytical work, and rigorous mathematical physics results were important. The
implications of shape dynamics go beyond the result on the arrow of time. If the theory is correct, it could transform the way that we think about singularities, the infinitely small and dense points thought to be at the heart of black holes and at the universe's origin at the Big Bang. At the moment, our laws of physics appear to break down at singularities, but Barber believes that this may be the wrong way of thinking about things.
Once you say that size has no meaning at all, then a lot of big issues in Einstein's theory of gravity may be completely transformed. The whole theory of singularities, whether anything serious happens at the Big Bang. You see, it was very significant when Roger Penrose was questioning me and disbelieving me. Roger said at the Big Bang, gravity is very strong and it's very important. And I said, if you take out scale, it isn't. It's exactly the opposite. Gravity ceases to play any role at the Big Bang because it's the shape of the universe is not changing significantly. This is our theory of shape dynamics, which I've been, luckily over the last 6 years or so, I've had this very good support from FQX, which has enabled me with collaborators to develop this where we're really beginning to make progress and understanding this. So shape dynamics, it looks to us as if it will give the same observational predictions as general relativity, but a very, very different conceptual picture. So it transforms this picture that one normally has of an incredibly violent Big Bang and explosion actually into the most benign, gentle state of affairs that you could imagine.
Just to sort of clarify what's happening there. So, you know, when Roger Penrose made his comment, he's talking in the sort of the conventional view where if we have scale in the picture, we think that as we get closer and closer to the Big Bang, because everything's crushing down, it's so small, and this is the role of gravity, squashing things into this infinitely small space. And what you're saying is that if you take size out of the picture and what you're really interested in is how shape is changing, that at the time of the Big Bang, there weren't very many dramatic changes in shape. The actual interesting changes in shape are happening later in the universe.
Yes. And at the Big Bang, all that is happening is like you would, if you opened a box of gas, you would just see the particles moving around relative to each other, more or less with the same speed, and just doing, nothing interesting would happen at all. That's what the Big Bang is. It's actually the least interesting place in the universe.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you very much, Julian. And thank you, Flavio.
Thank you to Julian Barber and Flavio Mercati for explaining their new work to Zia. And I guess now I know that the most boring place in the universe is the Big Bang. I always thought it was State College, Pennsylvania. Just kidding.
Okay. Yes, no offense. No offense to anyone there. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find links to Barber, Kozlowski and McCarty's paper, articles about their work, and previous podcast and video interviews with Barber. Brendan, you'll also be pleased to hear that there is an extended version of this interview on the website in which McCarty defends the view that the Big Bang is not the most boring or peaceful place in the universe.
Barber cited a number of books about time that inspired him, including the classic text by FQXI member Paul Davis, The Physics of Time Asymmetry. Davis is a world-renowned physicist and cosmologist with a long-running interest in the nature of time, and you could read articles about his physics research on the FQXI website. But in recent years, he's turned his attention to a very different puzzle, understanding cancer.
That's right. One of Davis' current roles is as head of the Center for the Convergence of Physical Science and Cancer Biology at Arizona State University. In September, he gave a plenary talk at a medical engineering conference at Imperial College London and described the work that is being done at the center. In particular, he spoke about a controversial theory for the origin of cancer that he has developed in collaboration with an oncologist and an astrobiologist. I caught up with Davis during the busy coffee session after his lecture and asked him to explain what his theory entails and the cancer therapies he recommends based on it.
I'd never really thought about cancer until I was approached by Anna Barker, the then deputy director of the National Cancer Institute a few years ago. And it's her brainchild to try to bring physicists and other physical scientists into cancer research, not just to help improve diagnostics or treatment, but by lending insights from those disciplines and problem-solving abilities. So I rashly agreed to become involved in this, and to cut a long story short, there were 12 centres set up for physical science and oncology, and I'm running the one at Arizona State University. So it seemed like a good idea at the time. If I'd have known the hard work that's involved, I might have thought twice about it. But actually, it's been a very exciting journey of discovery for me.
But what sort of insight can physicists and other physical scientists offer about cancer when it's something that's been really deeply studied by people that have spent their whole careers, their whole lives studying the biology of it, the biochemistry of it, the genetics of it, you know, dealing with patients, you know, working in the lab? You know, what can you bring to the table that they can't?
Well, cancer is a biological phenomenon. It's not well understood. Will we understand it by just throwing money at it? No, we can't spend our way to a solution. We've got to think our way to a solution. That's why it's so important to have people coming in, like myself coming in from the outside, to try to rethink the problem from the bottom up. We've got to just think our way through this. As a scientist working for most of my career on really foundational and fundamental aspects of science, I inevitably ask the questions, well, what is cancer? Why does it exist in the first place? And what are its deep evolutionary origins? And we think, that is myself and my collaborators, Charlie Lineweaver and Mark Vincent, we think we've identified some of the reasons that cancer is retained as an option in complex eukaryotic organisms like humans.
So you're really looking at cancer from a very different angle. You're sort of going much further back in time, looking at its kind of evolutionary development and asking, why is it still around now? What benefits does it bring? And how does that help? What benefits does it bring, and why is it important to think about them?
I think everybody recognizes that in some sense cancer is a throwback or a reversion to some more primitive type of life form. Sometimes people say, well, cancer behaves like selfish individual cells rather than part of a cooperative. Clearly the story of cancer goes back to the origin of multicellularity, which we think occurred about 1.5 billion years ago. Because what's happening in cancer is that ordinary somatic cells in the body are defying the normal regulatory arrangements, which is that they are supposed to undergo apoptosis or programmed cell death after a certain number of divisions. They're switching that off, and they're making a bid for immortality by having uncontrolled proliferation. So it's almost like going back to the unicellular world. So the question is, you know, what can you do with that? Well, the first thing is, if what we're saying is correct, that cancer is a sort of reversion to an earlier form of life, then we can ask, well, what was the world like at the time that multicellularity first emerged? And one example I can give you is that the oxygen levels were much lower then than they are now. It was a hypoxic world. And sure enough, cancer prefers hypoxic conditions. Cancer doesn't cope with oxygen and oxidative damage very well. And it defaults back to an ancestral type of metabolism called glycolysis, or fermentation, basically, in which it uses a very large amount of glucose, a very small amount of oxygen. So it's another way of metabolizing, making energy. It's far less efficient than the oxidative phosphorylation of healthy cells, but it's very good at making biomass. So it's using a type of metabolism that is adaptive for proliferation. It can make lots of stuff, but not very much energy. And one of the exciting things here, from the point of view of physics and engineering, is that for 50 years, cancer treatment has really been stuck in a rut. It's surgery often is the first thing, radiation and toxic chemicals, chemotherapy. You know, this is sort of depressing that when you look at the statistics, you use these traditional methods, there's a little bit of refinement here and there, and one or two conspicuous success stories, but overall, it's really not very good. But this isn't the only weapon in our armory. We can imagine controlling, maybe not eradicating, but controlling cancer using physical means. And oxygen is one example. If we can regulate the oxygen tension in a particular organ or a particular tumor, then This is one way of attacking the cancer, which is not really chemical, a non-toxic way of trying to combat cancer. So it's one example. There are many others, some involving electric fields and electric potentials. So another that we have been looking closely at is the way the cancer is more vulnerable than healthy cells to infection, that is, disease agents, viruses and bacteria. And this has been recognized for thousands of years, that tumors can suffer more than the healthy tissue from infection. It's just that infection might kill the patient as well. But if this is done intelligently, it may be possible to use viruses and bacteria to attack the cancer and stress the cancer more than the healthy cells, which can be protected by the immune system. And so we're working on that as a therapeutic strategy as well.
Let me ask you about those sort of suggested therapies that you've mentioned. With the sort of thinking about the amount of oxygen in the environment, there are tests that have been done, I understand, at least with animals, on the effects of oxygen on cancer. Can you talk a bit about that? And those have been carried out by independent researchers.
The ideal combination is to have low sugar, low glucose, and high oxygen, because the glycolysis, the fermentation mode of metabolism that cancer prefers, requires sugar and doesn't like oxygen. And so if you reverse that, then you would expect the cancer would do rather poorly. And some recent experiments with mice using a so-called ketogenic diet, which is a low glucose, high fat diet basically, combined with hyperbaric oxygen therapy, so delivering high levels of oxygen tension to all of the organs in the mice, does seem to be very effective in combating cancer. And so we think that this is a good approach to use with humans who may have late stage cancer that is unresponsive to traditional therapy. Basically, the patients have nothing to lose. It's too soon to say, well, this is a miracle cure. I don't think we've heard of miracle cures a lot. We don't need a miracle cure. All we need is to put the cancer under pressure to extend life. We don't have to get rid of the cancer. They're going to die of something else, to put it crudely.
You mentioned, you know, thinking about human trials in the future, and you sort of said, you know, this might be something that would be worth investigating with people at quite a late stage with cancer and they have nothing else to lose. But from a very naive perspective, as somebody that doesn't really know anything about this, it sounds like treating people with oxygen and changing their diet would be actually much less sort of damaging and have less sort of horrible side effects than many of the treatments that are, you know, being carried out at the moment, radiation and chemotherapy. So why target people at a later stage?
You're absolutely right, and this is entirely political. And I'll give you an example. So we work in collaboration with physicians, and I often will ask, well, why don't you recommend some of these non-standard therapies to some of your patients, where you can say, well, you know, we now sort of run out of options and there's nothing much more we can do, and the statistics say you've got 3 months to live. You know, go home and enjoy the rest of your life. Why don't you then refer them to some of these alternative treatments like the hyperbaric oxygen therapy? And the answer seems to be, unless there have been properly conducted clinical trials and legal safeguards put in place, this is a minefield. They cannot lend their own personal credibility or that of their institution, their hospital, for example, because if it turns out that this person whose life expectancy might be 3 months dies after 2 months, then they get the blame that they're using some quackery and dragging the good name of their hospital or their institution down. And there's another ugly thing in all this, which is money, because drug companies charge huge amounts for their drugs. They make a lot of profits. If you're going to say to somebody, well, there isn't a drug, it's not a drug, it's a hyperbaric oxygen, which is used in any case for all sorts of other reasons, then there are financial implications as well, basically. And so there's a huge disincentive, I think, for physicians to just suggest these alternative therapies. The other example I was going to mention is aspirin. Aspirin is the best anti-cancer drug we know. There have been clinical trials in Europe that show that it is effective against all of the major forms of cancer, both as a preventative and as a slowing mechanism. And you might think, well, why isn't everybody told about aspirin? Why are we talking about $100,000 a year drug treatments when aspirin is being overlooked? And the answer I am told from within the cancer community, well, nobody makes any money from aspirin. You buy it over the counter for a few pounds. And so it's a story that you'll be told what is correct, but you know, it's not shouted from the rooftops. And so I'm afraid money corrupts everything. And this whole cancer story is, in my view, a bit of a horror story.
Well, if sort of the oxygen therapy is thought to be controversial, then the other one that you mentioned is even more so, which is giving people sort of infections in order to target the cancer. And, you know, this is something that you say has a very long history, but it sounds like something that will be very, very difficult to get people to research now. Or am I wrong? Are people researching this in some capacity?
So you're right. This sounds sort of pretty barbaric. Now, one of the things that our theory predicts is that if cancer is a reversion to a phenotype more characteristic of 1.5 billion years ago than to the modern day, then a lot of more recently evolved capabilities in complex organisms like humans should be compromised or jettisoned or divested as part of this reprimitivization of the cancer cells. And one of these capabilities is the adaptive immune system, which is about 400 million years old. So it's ancient by many people's standards, but not ancient by the standards of cancer, which goes back before that. And it has been known ever since ancient Egypt that tumors will often vanish if the patient gets a serious fever or infection of some sort. And William Coley, at the turn of the 20th century, was mystified by the fact that there were less examples of spontaneous remission from cancer as a result of infection since the use of sterilization techniques. And so he deliberately infected his patients with some sort of cocktail of infectious agents to induce a fever, and found that there was a therapeutic effect. Now, the standard explanation for that is that if a cancer patient catches a disease, then their immune system is sort of boosted to fight the disease, and maybe the cancer gets knocked off as collateral damage. Well, that's going to be partially true, but we think that the story is that the cancer itself is actually more vulnerable to the disease because it is reverted back to this more primitive form, and so it finds it harder to fight off these diseases. And so selective infection of cancer patients seems like a pretty good way to go. But as you mentioned, there are ethical issues about deliberately infecting cancer patients. So obviously you have to plan a treatment regime rather carefully. But there has been experimentation recently, and in particular with viruses that seem to selectively attack cancer cells as opposed to healthy cells. And so there's a little bit of interest now, I think, in the use of microorganisms to infect cancer. So this is still a bit on the edge of cancer treatment, but it's not totally beyond the pale. And this is alongside the standard immunotherapy work, which aims to basically boost the immune system to try to control cancer in its earlier stages. So I see the basis of a whole new treatment regime, which is sort of giving up on man-made chemicals, which is what chemotherapy is, and using instead natural agents like viruses and bacteria to selectively stress the cancer.
Now, you've been talking a lot about your theory and how you think that sort of cancer is some kind of reversion back to an earlier stage in evolution. But it sounds a little bit technical, but I think you have a lovely example that you gave where it was kind of like a computer starting up in safe mode. So can you talk a little bit about that and how, you know, cancer might be triggered, sort of using that analogy?
The standard explanation for cancer is it's reinvented de novo in each organism. If you get cancer and I get cancer, that what happens is that the same disease with the same systematic pattern of behavior is sort of conjured up within the body each time by a sort of fast-paced Darwinism, a dream run of mutations which confer some sort of gain of function on a population of cells. And I've never been convinced by that, and I've never seen the mathematics to support it, that this is really the correct explanation. And to me, what seems much more likely is that, sure, there's some sort of genetic damage which is maybe compromising some of the regulatory arrangements surrounding these cells, but that's just a trigger for cancer. The cancer itself is driven by an ancient, I like to say, genetic program. That's a very simplistic way of putting it. It's not just a cassette of genes. It's a whole set of pathways, genetic and epigenetic, but an ancient core functionality, a little bit like safe mode in a computer. Because what's happening there is that the computer suffers some insult or stress, so it defaults back to its core functionality and divests itself of a lot of the more the bells and whistles that are associated with the more sophisticated later additions. And life is like that. We've got lots of sort of little tricks that have evolved over the last few hundred million years. The cancer divests itself of that. It goes back to that ancient core functionality, and it's running on that safe mode. And that provides both a strength and a weakness for cancer. Its strength is that it's protecting its core functionality, which is proliferation. Most treatments target the proliferative prowess of cancer, because chemotherapy typically targets cells that are proliferating rapidly and tries to kill those cells. But, you know, life has had nearly 4 billion years to perfect insults through its proliferative ability. So really that's targeting the strength of cancer. What you really want to do is target the weaknesses. And the weaknesses are going to be those things that cancer has jettisoned or has had removed in part of this default back to this core functionality. By running on safe mode, it can't do all these later sophisticated things. And these involve, for example, a whole series of efflux pumps. One of the things that cells have to do is pump out stuff that might threaten them, and that includes chemicals. So chemotherapy struggles against the cell's natural tendency to just pump the toxins right back out again. But if cells revert back to an earlier, more primitive form, then a lot of the more recently evolved efflux pumps won't work. So then the question is, you know, which ones evolved recently? Well, you can tell that by looking at the genes that control these efflux pumps. So we predict that as cancer progresses, it runs on more and more ancient genes, and the more recently evolved genes get downregulated or damaged in some way. And we can predict which they are by looking at the ages of the genes. So the key to our theory is looking at the ages of the genes responsible for cancer.
So now we're really talking about tests of your theory that could be carried out, you know, very soon and quite easily. So are there plans to kind of look into this, to look into gene ages? Is this something that people at your center are working on, or that you hope other people will be able to look into now?
Yes. So the short answer is, it's easy enough to test some of these basic ideas just from data mining, because we have the Cancer Genome Atlas, for example, that is telling us which genes are active in cancer. And then we have phylostratigraphic data, that is various databases that look at genes that we have in common with mushrooms and, you know, fruit flies and all that sort of thing. And we can trace back how far back these genes go. In other words, we can put an age on these genes. And these are two data sets that have never been combined together before. And we're trying to do that. Doesn't cost much money. It's a data analysis exercise. And so we're trying to do that. The field is a mess. The Cancer Genome Atlas is all over the place. Even the labeling of the genes can be ambiguous. And so we're trying to sort our way through that. But that's one way that we can go. The experimental tests would, of course, be much more welcome. We're making predictions about how cancer cells will respond to oxygen, for example, or how their efflux pumps will be up or down regulated. And we would very much like those experiments to be done. It's really hard to get funding in this field. You might think in the cancer industry that has so many billions sloshing around in it, a little bit of money could be found to do some experiments in these sorts of new areas. You wouldn't believe how hard it is to actually raise funding to do anything non-standard. And one of the depressing features about cancer research is how everyone's following everyone else down the same pathway. And doing anything a little bit out of the ordinary that costs money is a very, very hard thing to do.
That was Paul Davies talking with Zia about the merits of an interdisciplinary approach to fighting cancer.
There's an extended version of that interview on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. There, you'll also find a link to an article about Davies' research that I wrote for Scientific American and his new paper in bioessays outlining these ideas.
That's all we've got time for today.
Before we go, we should also wish the CERN Laboratory a happy 60th birthday. The organisation was founded on the 29th of September 1954. To celebrate, we're playing out with a new experimental composition that sonifies data gathered over a two-year stretch at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, played by scientists at the laboratory.
Thank you once again to Andrew Little, Julian Barber, Flavio Mercati, and Paul Davies. As always, you can reach us by email at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter @fqxi.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali. I'm sure Waterloo, Ontario is more boring than the Big Bang.
Thank you.